Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Financial Services Practice Group, was recorded on July 10, 2012, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on risk retention. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of the Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. As always, please also note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we have a panel of four experts to discuss the Dodd-Frank Act and risk retention. Each will speak for some 5 to 6 minutes, after which we'll have some discussion and then questions from the audience. Our speakers, in the order of their opening remarks, are Ms. Ann Canfield of Canfield & Associates, Mr. Michael Calhoun of the Center for Responsible Lending, Mr. Bert Ely of Ely & Company, and Mr. Alex Pollack of the American Enterprise Institute. There are some materials related to today's discussion provided by Ms. Canfield that are available on the Federalist Society's website, and also I believe we agreed to give her a few extra minutes as she's going to be giving us some of the background on today's topic. I'm not going to further describe the bios of these folks because they are also available on the Federalist Society's website. So with that, Ms. Canfield, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean, very much, and thanks to the Federalist Society for holding today's teleform. The Dodd-Frank Act was probably the most significant reform legislation impacting the financial services industry since the Great Depression. It requires regulators to promulgate hundreds of rulemakings, many of which will re-engineer the mortgage finance industry. The two most important Dodd-Frank provisions related to consumer mortgages are the qualified mortgage, or QM, provision and the qualified residential mortgage, or QRM, provision. Both provisions are now the subject of separate proposed rulemakings and are intended to define a more sustainable mortgage. In addition, the Dodd-Frank Act lowered the high-cost mortgage, or HOPA thresholds as they are known, while expanding the reach of HOPA liability to include purchase money loans. Finally, in 2010, the Department of Housing and Urban Development proposed to incorporate a disparate impact theory of liability as opposed to disparate treatment into its regulation under the Fair Housing Act. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the Department of Justice have made clear that they are committed to enforcing the Equal Credit Opportunity Act using a disparate impact theory of liability. The interplay between the QRM, QM, and HOPA rules, along with the disparate impact litigation, could be very damaging to the housing markets unless they are very, very carefully crafted. So let's turn first to the QRM rule. The QRM rule is a QRM loan is exempt from the Dodd-Frank requirement that securitizers retain 5% of the credit risk when they securitize assets, including mortgage loans. The law required six agencies at the federal level to jointly prescribe implementing rules. The regulators issued their proposed QRM rule and received public comments through August of last year, August 1st of 2011. They have not yet announced their plans to issue a final rule or, in light of all of the comments that were received, whether they will substantially revise and repropose the rule for a second comment period. Regulators, however, have signaled that they are planning on finalizing the rule after the QM rule is completed. The proposed QRM definition in the joint regulator proposed rule is for a closed-end loan with the following characteristics: a maximum loan-to-value ratio, or LTV ratio, of 80% for purchase money loans, which means a 20% down payment requirement, a maximum of LTV of 75% for rate and term refinances, and 70% for cash-out refinances. Maximum front-end and back-end DTI ratios of 28 and 36% respectively. On any debt, the borrower cannot be more than 30 days past due. In the past 24 months, they can't be 60 days past due. In the past 36 months, they cannot have had any bankruptcy, repossession, foreclosure, deed in lieu, short sale, or judicial judgment on any debt. And then points and fees on QRM loans cannot exceed 3% of the loan amount. And the loan cannot have a negative amortization, a balloon, a term longer than 30 years. And if it's an adjustable rate mortgage, rate increases are capped at 2 percentage points per year and 6 percentage points over the life of the loan. Moreover, the definition of a QRM by statute may be no broader than the QM definition. While risk retention applies to all types of securitized loans, the premium capture reserve account provisions in the proposed QRM rule will effectively prevent the securitization of non-exempt mortgage loans. Re-REMIX, for example, will not be possible under the proposed rule. Dodd-Frank exempted FHA and VA loans from the risk retention requirements. The proposed rule also exempts Fannie and Freddie loans while they are into conservatorship, although the regulators can extend the exemption after the GSEs emerge from conservatorship. The six agencies that advanced the proposed rule informally suggested that the risk retention rule would result in a 10 to 15 basis point increase in rates for non-QRM loans. The industry had a very different view. Their estimates ranged that non-QRM loans would be priced up by anywhere from 80 to 185 basis points. That brings me to the second issue, the new lower HOPA thresholds in the Dodd-Frank Act. HOPA loans have not traditionally, very few HOPA loans have been made because they subject lenders and assignees to enhanced truth in lending or TILA damages. For example, in 2009, only 6,500 HOPA loans were made, according to the General Accounting Office, and we believe that those loans were probably made in error because they were right up against the edge. Dodd-Frank expanded the liability, so you can expect that lenders will be more, even more unwilling to make loans above the HOPA thresholds. So if you're, you know, we know that QRM loans are non-QRM loans are going to be priced up, and depending on the amount of markup on those loans, they will more easily hit the new lower HOPA thresholds. And once those loans hit the lower thresholds, they're not really going to be made because of the liability and also reputational risk to both the lenders and assignees. That brings us, the QRM definition which is proposed is quite narrow, and it's important because depending on how the third issue, the qualified mortgage rule, turns out, it may be that the fallback de facto safe harbor from QM liability, which I'll talk about in a second here, may be that lenders simply just do QRM loans. So if that rule is fairly narrowly defined, that may really restrict credit. The qualified mortgage rule was proposed by the Federal Reserve Board and will be finalized by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Originating a QM loan under the requirements set forth by the Dodd-Frank Act ensures that a creditor makes a reasonable and good faith determination based upon verified and documented information that the time the loan is consummated, the consumer has a reasonable ability to repay the loan according to its terms, including all applicable taxes, insurance, including mortgage guarantee insurance, and assessment. Unlike the QRM provisions, the QM provisions apply to almost all mortgage loans, whether they're securitized, held in portfolio, or guaranteed by the government. The liability for a violation of the ability to repay requirement, or the QM definition, is intended to be harsh. It can subject creditors and assignees to liability for, quote-unquote, enhanced damages. Prior to the enactment of the Dodd-Frank Act, only HOPA violations were subject to enhanced damages. Enhanced damages can include the sum of all of the following: actual damages, twice the finance charge, all the fees paid, the consumer paid, statutory damages up to $4,000, court costs, reasonable attorney's fees associated with enforcement action. Significantly, Dodd-Frank expanded the statute of limitations from 1 to 3 years for certain violations and applied the 3-year limit to violations of ability to repay requirements. Moreover, borrowers may assert ability to repay violations as a defense to foreclosure even after the 3-year statute of limitations has lapsed. In this event, the liability is limited to damages that would have been available for 3 years before the 3 years lapse, plus costs and attorney's fees. These damages are likely to exceed the profit on any loan. Enhanced damages for ability to repay violations provide in our view, individual borrowers and their counsel with a strong arsenal in the event of default to delay foreclosure and to obtain substantial compensation by threatening litigation. Any borrower who wishes to delay a foreclosure or wishes compensation, regardless of the merits, has an incentive to raise ability to pay allegations. In fact, in our view, once the ability to repay rules are enforced, it might constitute malpractice for a borrower's attorney not to at least attempt to bring such a claim, because settling will almost always be less expensive, you know, for the lenders than continued litigation, regardless of the merits of the action. Investors are also at risk because assignees may be liable if the violation was apparent on the face of the disclosure. So this is probably the QM provision, the most significant of all the provisions in the Dodd-Frank Act, and it's extremely important. It is, as I mentioned, in the proposed rule stage, it's extremely important that it turn out correctly. Finally, as I mentioned, the administration is moving forward on implementing a disparate impact theory of liability. As you might have guessed, under the QRM rule, the lower HOPA thresholds, and the QM rule, it's designed to really shrink the availability of mortgage credit to from the levels that existed during the boom period. But that has a complicating factor because, unfortunately, not all borrowers are created equal when it comes to their credit worthiness. And under disparate impact, the lenders are going to be required to manage the outcomes of their lending practices rather than just ensuring that they don't discriminate. And so with the lending constraints that are going to come as a result of these rules, it may, have a disparate impact on minority populations, and that places the lenders in a catch-22 position because, on the one hand, they are trying to live with the provisions that are leading to a more conservative underwriting standards, but at the same time, if they do that, their outcomes are not going to look very good. So this is a complicating factor that is currently being debated in Washington, and we'll have to see how all this turns out. The bottom line is that to prevent all these rules from interfering with each other and to enable good mortgage loans to be made, it is really, really important that everybody understand the interplay between all of them, and that the regulators carefully thread the needle in finalizing the proposed rules. In our view, the QRM loan should be broadened. The QM definition should be really broader than QRM, and at the same time, they need to implement clearly define what a QM loan is so that lenders are not at cross purposes with the disparate impact theory of liability. And it also needs to be clearly defined so that it prevents, lenders from being subject to meritless litigation. So with that, I hope that's a pretty quick overview of the panoply of the major rules that are in play impacting the mortgage industry. And I'm going to turn it over to Mike Calhoun, who is at the Center for Responsible Lending, for the next presentation. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Ann. And I am the president of the Center for Responsible Lending. We are the policy affiliate of a community development lender that specializes in home loans, particularly for those with impaired credit. We make a substantial number of those loans and retain all of the credit and litigation risk on those loans. As I speak, I want to let you know there's a major thunderstorm going through the area where I'm located, so if you hear any rumbles in the background, I apologize that Mother Nature's adding some background noise there. I think, first of all, that there is a lot of consensus on what the current situation is and what the goal of where we're trying to get the housing to market. During the financial crisis, while there are differences about the reasons for the quality of mortgages that were being originated. I think there's undisputable evidence that that quality was very low. What we had seen is niche products, the no-doc loans, the loans without escrows became mainline affordability products. And the U.S. mortgage market had probably the worst loan quality of the major mortgage markets in the developed world, who all experienced some price declines, or almost all of them did, but it was particularly severe here in the North America and the United States because of the very poor quality of the mortgages. Second, I think there is agreement that credit is too constrained right now. I don't think anyone believes that the market is sufficiently operating and providing credit at this point. Families with high credit standards have difficulties qualifying for loans right now. And third, that the housing market is critical. It usually leads us out of recessions. In this case, the housing market remains a major drag on the economic recovery, with, for example, new housing starts, while improving, still being at levels that rival post-World War II lows for housing production. So as Ann laid out the tools that are involved, the four that she has addressed, the QM, which is the qualified mortgage, which is really the foundation because that will largely, along with the QRM, define the mortgage market. The QRM, which is the rule that decides which mortgages are subject to the risk retention requirement. The new HOPA rules, and then the equal credit access rules. And let me go through them quickly. And the one that I think is really the foundation is the QM, or qualified mortgage, which defines which loans presumably meet the ability to repay. And there are three main issues that arise under that rule. The first is, how broad do you want the QM market? Should it be most of the market, with only niche products being outside the QM market, somewhat a return of where we were in the mid-90s, or should it be a small segment of the market? The second is, should the standards for QM be relatively bright lines, such as numerical benchmarks, or should they be more subjective standards? And lastly, and probably the most hotly contested issue right now, is should QM loans receive a safe harbor, that is, be absolutely protected from any claim that there was not ability to repay, or should they just receive a rebuttable presumption that assists the lender in proving that there was ability to repay? So let me go through those quickly. The first two issues, I think there's broad consensus on these, that most major lenders are saying they only want to do qualified mortgages. They believe they'll have to make representations to those they sell, whether it be government entities or private investors, that their loans meet the QM standards. Those non-QM loans will likely be primarily specialty portfolio lenders. And so I think there's been most market participants, industry, consumer, have advocated a broad QM market, that most lending should take place within that definition. So then the second issue is, how do you define what that QM loan is? And one of the real driving factors in that has been lenders need a high degree of certainty when they underwrite a loan to know that it is a QM loan. It creates too much legal risk for them, and we can get into the particulars of that later. And so they want to be certain, and if there is a high degree of uncertainty of whether it's a QM loan, they naturally will be even more conservative on their underwriting and on their credit availability. And I think there is wide agreement that credit availability is too constrained now, and so that's an undesirable result. So that leads to a desire for brighter line standards. The other really driving factor in this is that today we have seen not a flood of borrower claims arising out of mortgage underwriting, even through the financial crisis that we've experienced, but we have seen unprecedented so-called buyback claims, where investors, particularly governmental investors, including the GSEs, Fannie and Freddie, FHA, have said to lenders, you represented these loans had this characteristic, and they don't, and they're in default, you have to buy them back at face value. While consumer claims have remained very modest, these buyback claims have resulted in tens of billions of dollars of lender buyback payments. And we'll get a really key distinction is between a consumer claim and a buyback claim, the consumer has to show they were unable to repay the loan because of this violation. In the context of a buyback claim, the investor merely needs to show that the loan did not meet the represented qualifications that were claimed, and the investor does not have to prove that that's the reason the loan went into default, which makes buyback claims really the big driving force. And so the focus has been on how do you come up with bright line standards. The central point of that has generally been a debt to income, which is connected to, which would be usually a back end ratio, meaning all of the borrower's debts, including housing, compared to their gross before tax income. And it's, the proposals have generally centered around something in the mid 40%, because FHA uses 43%, the GSEs use up to 45%, and allow compensating factors to go up to 50%. And then similarly, there would be compensating factors have been proposed for the QM standard that would allow borrowers to go above 43%. For example, if they had been making previous rental or housing mortgage payments at that level, if they had substantial reserves, or if an analysis showed they had significant residual income, even with a housing payment at that level. So the third question comes down to, is there a safe harbor or rebuttable presumption? For safe harbor, it would mean if the loan meets those QM standards, then the borrower is precluded from challenging ability to repay. In our view, setting a broad QM standard with a market with bright line standards forces you to have a rebuttable presumption for this reason, that to include a broad market with bright line standards, you will inevitably have to have generous standards that will clearly allow some unaffordable loans to meet the standard. So, for example, a debt-to-income ratio of 43%. While that works for the majority of borrowers, for borrowers such as those on modest fixed income, if your income is $2,000 a month of Social Security, it is very difficult to make a housing payment and other debt payments of 43% of your income and have enough money left to pay your basic expenses and necessities. And so we would rather see those standards be bright line because of the threat of all the buyback claims and that effect on credit availability, and for them to be broad enough to have most of the market, again, to enhance credit availability, and allow a rebuttable presumption. We believe that precedent and the structure of these rules shows that there will be very few of these claims. For example, there are a number of states that have ability to repay provisions, virtually no litigation. There have been other similar state remedies, including North Carolina, which was very broad, again, virtually no litigation even through this area. And the reason is, again, there are structural obstacles. It's not as easy as playing a lottery ticket for a borrower to see if they can get a settlement, because these are individualized claims. They are not susceptible to class action, and they almost always require an expert witness, which requires either the borrower, who is in financial distress, facing foreclosure, not able to make their mortgage payments, to come up with the money, or the attorney to come up with cash. It's unlike other litigation like Truth in Lending, which is much more like a buyback claim, where if you show a technical violation, you get a substantial remedy. Here, you have to prove a violation and that this was the reason you could not repay the loan. Let me quickly go through the other one to save time for other speakers. So the second was the QRM, the Qualified Residential Mortgage, which determines which loans are subject to the buyback requirement. First of all, the buyback, the risk retention requirement was largely watered down. When it was originally proposed by Chairman Frank, he was talking about 10 to 15% of the principal of the loan. In its current form, it's 5% of the credit risk, not the principal, the credit risk. On a very risky portfolio, that would be 20% losses. 5% of that means a one-time fee of 100 basis points or 1%, which is a cost and aggravation of doing business rather than real risk retention. We think the QM, if it's done properly, produces risk reduction, which is the real key here. And the statute does not require, it only permits the regulators to see, not the CFPB, but six financial regulators and HUD, including HUD, to add on to the QM. We strongly believe, particularly in this market, that the QRM should be the same as QM. They should exercise their discretion to not add on to the QM for regulatory simplicity. It's unnecessary, and it just adds greater uncertainty. The other two issues quickly are the HOPA rules, where the fee level was raised, threshold was lowered from 8 to 5 points, and some additional items were included in there. It still is important to note that the HOPA rate limit in today's market would be about a 10% mortgage, the annual percentage rate on the mortgage. So while it has limits on fees, it's hard to find many mortgages that at 5 points in upfront fees, and in today's market for first lien, 10%, and it's a higher rate for second liens, that does not provide a lot of flexibility to make loans. And then finally, on the disparate impact, and I don't dispute that all these should be considered together and they're cumulative how they interact together, that in the disparate impact, that has been the law of every single court of appeals has ruled disparate impact is the rule. And so that has been the standard for the last decade and a half in the country. It's not suddenly this new standard. It is true that the Department of Justice has been more aggressive in enforcing these claims, but the disparate impact standard has been the law of the land for some time now. So my final point is, I think, as noted, the uncertainty of getting all these rules has had a significant dampening effect on the market, and it is hard and critical to get these rules right. So we would urge caution to make sure these rules don't overreach, but we also are optimistic that once these rules are in place, they'll be a blueprint for a successful housing market for generations to come. Thank you, and let me pass it on to Bert, who I know will have some of his usual very insightful comments on this.
Thank you, Michael. I want to focus on something that may initially not seem related, but the QR and QM, but in fact will be, and that is proposed changes in the regulatory capital framework for banks and thrifts. These are rules that were proposed just last month. They are a complement to the international Basel III risk-based capital rules, and what I think is important to realize is that the fundamental thrust of these rules is to increase the amount of capital that banks need to hold against various types of risks, and specifically mortgage risks, both with regard to mortgages they may retain on a balance sheet. That's where they retain the ownership of it, and you know these would be QM loans, as well as residual exposures they may have for mortgages that they securitize, such as gain on sale income that they have to amortize over a period of time for mortgages that they sold. What concerns me is, and I think it should concern everybody involved in housing finance, and that is that these capital rules, which are coming along on a parallel track or a separate track from the QRM and QM rules, will have the impact of imposing costs on FDIC-insured institutions, basically banks and thrifts and holding companies, that will be represent additional cost to banks in addition to the types of costs that Ann Canfield made reference to in her remarks. So what we have to be concerned about is just this piling on of cost. What I find particularly interesting here is that while the rulemaking on QRM and QM is coming from the basically from the CFPB, I mean, it's going to be the focus of this, which, of course, is a consumer protection regulatory agency. The capital rules are coming from the safety and soundness side, if you will, of the bank regulatory establishment. And it's not clear to me if there's any degree of coordination, much less measurement, of the potential impact of these two sets of rules coming down parallel paths and coming on stream over roughly the same period of time. And what is particularly interesting here is that in these risk-based capital rules across the board, and specifically with regard to residential mortgage lending, is a much greater degree of granularity in terms of the measurement of risk. And with that greater degree of granularity is a requirement, an obligation, to gather more detailed, more refined data about individual assets that banks have on their books or have securitized. And a lot of this data isn't just simple data that you can pull out of accounting records, but data such as loan-to-value ratios and type of mortgage and so forth that a bank will have to capture and integrate into its accounting system for the purposes of computing capital ratios. In other words, this data has obviously been collected in the past through the loan underwriting process, but it now has to be integrated into the calculations that take place in making and determining what a bank's capital ratios are for regulatory purposes. And those ratios are central to the safety and soundness regulation of banks and thrifts. So banks now face, in the residential mortgage lending area, as well as in other other areas of lending and investing, they have to not only go out and make sure they're capturing the data properly, but integrating it into their accounting systems in a way that they have not done so before. There's going to be not only a lot of cost in doing that, that ultimately has to flow back to the borrower, or in this case, whoever's taking out a home mortgage, but this also increases compliance risk. That is, the risk that the bank has incorrectly captured the data and compiled it. And this is a compliance risk that is totally separate from the compliance risks that may arise with regard to QRM and QM that both of the previous speakers referred to. So we have, as I say, coming along on a parallel path, a whole new set of costs and compliance requirements and compliance risks that just add on to another layer of cost and risk to the mortgage lending process. And the thing that concerns me and others who have looked at this is that, first of all, we have a situation where there's been very little, if any, effort to really try and quantify what the impact of these new capital-related requirements will be, but then how lenders, and particularly smaller banks and thrifts, will deal with these costs. And what concerns some of us who are starting to drill down into this is that a number of institutions, particularly, again, smaller ones, will look at some of these requirements and say it just isn't worthwhile to stay in all the different lines of lending that we're doing. And so what we may see over the few years it will take to implement these new capital rules is one more reason for banks and thrifts to pull back from some of their residential mortgage lending activities. And this comes back to a point that Ann Canfield made earlier, and that is, will this just add further to a reduction of mortgage credit availability, at least the availability of mortgage credit from FDIC-insured institutions? And, of course, that raises the you know, the broader question, if banks and thrifts pull back, what will replace them? Who will be the lenders that are not only originating mortgages, but, for instance, holding mortgages in portfolio and assuming securitization risk? And what I think is important here is that unlike the CFPB rules or pending rules and proposed rules with regard to QRM and QM, which are getting a lot of attention, and understandably so, that the impact of these new regulatory capital rules and the implementation of Basel III on residential lending have not really been assessed. I think very few people have even really started to think about the potential implication of those rules, and yet there are some very real implications that will become realized over the next few years. And so as bankers and lawyers are looking at what the future holds for residential mortgage lending in the concept of the rules that are being developed by the CFPB and the other agencies with regard to QRM and QM and HOPA rules and so forth, they must also keep sight of and be evaluating the impact, and particularly the cost impact, of also having to comply with much more conservative capital rules that are coming, being laid on the banks and thrifts as a result of the housing finance crisis. I'll end my comments there and turn it over to Alex Pollack for final comments before we go to questions and answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Bert. Thanks to the Federalist Society for the call, and thanks especially to my colleagues on the panel for those very informative remarks they all made. My comments will be less informative and more philosophical on the topic in particular of credit risk retention by lenders. Credit risk retention is an old idea in finance. It's a natural idea that when you create credit risk by loans you've made, it's natural and a good idea in some circumstances that you keep that credit risk. Of course, if you keep your own loan, you automatically keep it, but we're dealing here with loans which are sold or participated in by others. When I was a trainee in the bank a long time ago, and we were dealing with loan syndications, it was explained to me that you always have to ask them how much of the deal they are keeping that they want you to buy into in this syndicate, and that was a logical question. And it is true that retention of credit risk creates an obvious alignment of incentives and of due care, so I'm a fan of risk retention or skin in the game. But I believe that this should be on a voluntary market basis, a voluntary contract outcome. It's not the only way to do things, and it shouldn't be a mandated formulaic requirement as it is, of course, in the Dodd-Frank Act. For residential mortgages in particular, and in dealing with their credit risk, I believe local community banks have a natural and significant competitive advantage. In the credit risk, they don't, of course, have any advantage in holding the interest rate risk of long-term fixed rate. assets so that you can divide those two functions by using credit risk and retention of skin in the game while the interest rate risk moves someplace else. If you do that, the bank retaining the risk should be explicitly paid for managing the pure credit risk, and that should be a proper and a profitable line of business, if I'm right, that especially for community banks, this is a natural competitive advantage. As some of you know, this simple idea is the basis of the Mortgage Partnership Finance Program, which we invented 15 years ago or so at the Chicago Federal Home Loan Bank, and that program is now offered by a number of home loan banks. One of the things that was most enjoyable about developing it was how much it was hated by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Since its operation began in 1997, Mortgage Partnership Finance's credit performance based on skin in the game or credit risk retention has been extremely good, and it's been very profitable for the participating mortgage lenders. But in my idea, we don't need or want a uniform mandated risk retention structure that applies everywhere in the very large mortgage market. I picture instead a mortgage financing market in its secondary financing aspect, which is of course a very large part of the market, in which securitizations without credit risk retention, securitizations with credit risk retention, whole loan sales without credit risk retention, and whole loan sales with credit risk retention, all are there and all compete for investor interest, and we'll discover by pricing the value of these various structures and the extent of whether skin in the game has value to investors. You'll note in this, I have mentioned a whole loan secondary market, which makes a lot of sense in my view, since Dodd-Frank has created such burdens and risks for private securitization of mortgages. We ought to be exploring simple transactions in whole loans as well, as I say, with and without credit risk retention. As a last thought on the topic of credit risk retention, in my view, there's another market that much needs such retention or skin in the game, and that is the market for student loans, a growing problem whose difficulties are being widely recognized, of course. And the people who should be eligible to provide skin in the game are the colleges themselves. The colleges who promote student loans, who benefit from student loans, who take the cash and spend it, could have a first loss position in each cohort pool of these loans, and that would be a sensible alignment of incentives, just as it is in mortgages. Thanks very much.
Okay, well, thank you to all four of our panelists. I do want to have some discussion between and among our panelists. We only have about 15 minutes left on our call, but I do want to give, especially Ann Canfield, who went first, and some of the other earlier opening remarks, a chance to respond to things they may be heard in later presentations. Ann, do you want to take a minute or two and start our conversation?
Sure. First, as a general commentary, I say I think the listeners can heard today the mortgage market and the larger financial services industry is going through a tremendous state of flux with all of the upheaval that's going on with the regulations. And I agree with Mike Calhoun in that, resolving these issues as soon as possible will, I think, provide some more stability. I do disagree, however, Mike, with you on two points. One is, first, let's just talk about the disparate impact theory of liability. Well, I do know that there are different court decisions at the circuit court level. The Supreme Court has established what the law of the land is, and that was done in the Ward's Cove decision in 1989. And basically, under Ward's Cove, the Supreme Court articulated standards for the burden-shifting framework that the court explained were standards that the court believed employers could actually meet and that would keep courts from being placed in a position of restructuring a company's business practices. So in our view, the CFPB, the Department of Justice, and HUD, you know, should follow what the Supreme Court's law of the land is and follow the Ward's Cove standards. And they so far are not doing it. HUD has not proposed that in their proposed rule. CFPB and DOJ are going to enforce under a very different standard. So on that score, you know, in our view, the CFPB, the Ward's Cove, you know, basically said, we believe that a prima facie case under the effects test must be based only on statistics that compare borrowers who are actually similarly situated. This means that borrowers must have similar credit worthiness characteristics, be located in similar markets, and have applied for similar products. In other words, the analysis must not compare borrowers to the general populations, population of members of the prohibited basis group. Also, you know, lenders must be able to defend against statistical disparities by pointing to a legitimate business justification. And in our view, the legitimate business, you know, justification could be that, you know, the qualified mortgage rule or the qualified residential mortgage rule or any of these rules that we're going to have to live with, you know, basically, you know, required them to impose a, you know, a more conservative underwriting standard. So, you know, there's some other things I won't go on, but to me, Ward's Cove was the Supreme Court decision. They established the law of the land, and despite what lower courts may have decided more recently, the Supreme Court's decision sets the standard. Secondly, with regard to the rebuttable presumption versus safe harbor issue, we are very concerned that there will be a whole new cottage industry of lawyers basically representing individual claimants, particularly since their attorney's fees, you know, are going to be paid, court costs are going to be paid, the penalties are fairly significant. So in our view, what happened in Dodd-Frank is that there is the playing field was shifted. There, you would have to be an idiot as a consumer not to hire an attorney and try and get some sort of settlement under an ability to repay claim at any point during the life of your mortgage. You're limited to 3 years worth of interest or whatever. The penalty period is 3 years. You can make that claim anytime during the life of the mortgage. And as I said, yes, there are not class action suits, but in our view, we are very concerned that there is going to be an entire new industry develop out there. I don't believe that the state level, and I could be wrong on this, but I don't believe that any of the state laws provided the generous compensation that the Dodd-Frank Act did. So I think that changes the equation. Those are my points that I'd like to point out to the group. And Mike, you might have some extra commentary as well as Alex and Bert.
Who else wants to jump in at this point?
Bert, just very quickly, I want to pick up on something that Alex said with regard to local community lenders and credit risk retention. I think he makes an excellent point that particularly for smaller banks and thrifts lending in their local market, they're not only more likely to know the borrower, but also quirks in local market conditions. And so they are very well placed to retain credit risk. But what concerns me under the QRM and QM rules, but also under the pending changes in bank capital regulation, that it will just become too much of a compliance burden and cost for these institutions to stay in business. And what the impact of the unintended impact of these regulations may be is to drive out of the residential mortgage lending market a lot of smaller institutions that are especially well positioned to assume credit risk. And I don't see where anybody in the economy gains from that.
What about the large versus small institutions? Does anybody else want to weigh in on that?
Well, if I, just to jump on that very quickly, we are seeing large institutions gaining market share, and my concern is that the combination of all these regulatory changes, both from a consumer protection standpoint as well as a safety and soundness standpoint, are going to lead to increased concentration in mortgage lending and therefore less in the way of innovation and product availability.
I'd like to come back, it's Alex, to another point if I could, Dean.
Go right ahead, Alex.
And that is, I think all of us have agreed that at the moment credit risk in the mortgage market is overly constrained. That's one of the things holding up a more robust recovery. The problem is that the in addition to a normal cyclical reaction after the bust, which is to constrain credit, we have, in addition, all of these regulatory risks and legal risks and burdens, as have been extensively discussed, coming on the market. So as we look forward, we have to say, is this going to create a going forward situation, just as Bert asked, where you have an overly depressed and constrained mortgage lending and credit availability? Now, Bert made it pretty clear that that was a rhetorical question, and he was implying the answer was yes, that's what it does mean. I just like to say, let's make it explicit. The answer is yes, especially in the case if we do not get a safe harbor for the lenders with bright line standards, you are looking at a continually constrained and underperforming mortgage market going forward, in my opinion.
We would agree with that. It is a very serious concern, and I agree with Mike Calhoun that, you know, when he started out and the others, credit is very tight today. It's overly tight, and it's important that these rules be carefully crafted so that we don't continue with those tight lending standards. We don't want them, of course, to go back to the way they were. I agree with Mike completely that the securitization of no-doc, low-doc loans was just horrendous. It led to an enormous amount of fraud occurring in the system. I mean, for people that are doing loan-by-loan reviews of these of the loan files, they're finding that in the no-doc, low-doc area that there's somewhere between 75 to 85% of the loans are fraud. So, you know, those no-doc, low-doc loans used to be a portfolio product for, you know, it was a private banking product for well-heeled, customers of a lot of local banks. But, when they started securitizing those products, that was a disaster, particularly since the rating agencies, you know, first the GSEs, you know, you had no access to any of the data in the loan files on the loans that they guaranteed, and then the rating agencies, of course, gave overly generous ratings, and then there were derivative products off of those. So it just wound up funding an awful lot of loan activity that should never have been funded.
And it's Alex. When you talk about those horrendous fraud numbers, who's fraud? The borrower, the broker?
The borrower signed the papers. It's very hard to prove that. I mean, clearly the borrower signed the papers, and it's hard to know whether the broker, you know, said, oh, this is how you fudge the papers or whatever. I'm sure there's a mix of both. What we are finding, though, or the people that are reviewing these files, is that they either lied about their income and or, which is very often the case, they said that this was their, you know, going to be their primary residence and it's about their sixth investment property or something like that. So clearly in that case, the borrower knew that, you know, that wasn't their sixth investment property. This sort of gets to another issue, too. I mean, the CFPB came out with their proposed mortgage disclosures yesterday, and it, I haven't read through the rule. It's a 1,099-page proposed rule, so we'll be commenting on that down the road here. But I think it's very important that, you know, as part of this restructuring, that consumers get mortgage loan disclosures that they can understand and that are tailored to the product of their choice. So, you know, if they are signing up for, a fixed rate product at the beginning of the mortgage transaction, they get to closing, that disclosure should be the same disclosure, and it should, you know, basically disclose the 30-year fixed rate product. And if all of a sudden there's ARM loan features on that disclosure, that means that there's fraud occurring someplace. And so, you know, this disclosure stuff is, you know, very, very detailed and technical, but it does play into all of this. I also, just as a general, this is just my own general point of view, I don't think no-doc, low-doc loans should be securitized. I think that would have eliminated a huge amount of the problem that occurred.
We've got something less than 5 minutes left. Why don't we go to the audience? Looks like we have at least one caller with a question. Let's take that question and then move on from there.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. If I may squeeze in several questions in the time available, what about assignability of the retained risk? What about the retained risk for the servicing agent? How is the borrower protected if the servicing agent goes out of business, not having passed on his payments? And finally, whatever happened to the best evidence rule that a debt was voidable if the original signed note could not be produced in court on demand?
Mike, do you want to take that?
Who wants to respond?
Well, I'll start with that and just say, I mean, I think those all reflect the fact that there was a lack of basic standards in the mortgage origination and servicing industry, and that led to pressure where the lowest common denominator prevailed. And so, for example, in servicing, people paid high prices for servicing rights. There weren't basic rules about how the loan servicing had to be done. And so to understandably try to maximize profits, people were cutting corners in the process. And I think that's one of the places where the CFPB and the financial regulators can come in and set those basic rules. We've seen something similar with credit cards, where we had essentially no rules in place, and so you ended up with these very complex double credit billing cycles and all this stuff that even financial experts didn't understand. The Credit Card Act, I think, came pretty close to getting it right, as I think a lot of the credit card companies have acknowledged, that it set some basic rules in place and then let the free market, let the winner be decided by who provides the best service for consumers and to investors. And that's what we would urge to be done in the mortgage market. We think Dodd-Frank does a good job of starting us down that road. We agree with the other speakers here that there has to be great care, that these are rules that can add complexity and unseen risk, and you don't want to unnecessarily squeeze down on credit availability. So we will disagree on some of the specifics and technicals, but I think our overall view is similar.
Who else wants to weigh in on this point?
I would agree with Mike that there are rules being put in place with regard to servicing standards. There was a settlement agreement between a number of the larger players. I think those standards will be expanded to impact the rest of the market. And I think that some of the practices of the past are hopefully going to be in the past.
This is Bert. If I could just jump in
with
a point on that, though, and that is that as these new servicing requirements and rules are put in place, we do have a number of smaller banks out there that service some of their mortgages, particularly the ones they retain in portfolio. And I just wonder to what extent we'll see a number of smaller institutions get out of loan servicing because, again, the cost of complying as well as compliance risk will be such that it just isn't worthwhile. And I would ask the question, is that really in the best interest of the housing finance market going forward?
We would totally agree that the housing mortgage market is too concentrated. One of the real ironies is of too big to fail is that the big banks are even bigger now than they were before the financial crisis, and that is seen perhaps most dramatically in the mortgage market, where last quarter, as many folks know, we had one mortgage provider for the first time have more than a third of all mortgages in the country that they originated in the first quarter of this year. And we have favored measures that protect the community banks, particularly the smaller lenders and particularly those who portfolio their loans, because as was noted earlier, if you portfolio a loan, you have a lot of incentive to underwrite it and service it correctly.
I think that's there is a very real concern over the impact of these rules on smaller and medium-sized lenders. Most of those institutions don't have, you know, large legal staffs to wade through all this. The liability is significant. So that's why it's very, very important that these rules be done correctly and that they be the rules be clear so the compliance is easy. You know, small to medium-sized institutions not only don't have the huge legal staffs in place, but they also, you know, can't afford to risk being sued a lot either.
Hey, Mike, this is Alex. I assume that your affiliate, in addition to holding loans, services all its own loans?
We actually contract out most of the servicing.
Oh, you do?
Because of the economies of doing that.
And do, so are any of the provisions here we're talking about worrisome to you with respect to servicing those loans that that you all as a group are making?
So we retain all the credit and interest rate risk on the loans and litigation risk on the loans. The servicing, again, while at times we have done our own servicing, at present we contract all that out.
Uh-huh.
I think this, to that point, Alex, I think the CFPB is working on servicing standards, and that's apart from the rules that we've been discussing here today.
Well, folks, so. We are out of time, and I don't want to abuse the privilege of taking the time of our audience members here. Also, I think a couple of our speakers have other business to attend to, so I'm going to call this to a halt. But I do want to thank our panel. I think we've covered a lot of ground here. There's a lot more to be said, so maybe we'll schedule another one of these sometime in the not-too-distant future. But thank you to all our panelists on behalf of the Federalist Society. We certainly appreciate your participation. Thanks, of course, to the audience as well. And we invite you to visit the Federalist Society's webpage and the teleforum page on that site to look for a schedule of upcoming calls. But for now, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.